Stay tuned for The Turning Point with Mike Fader. This is Mike Fader with The Turning Point. I just want to mention before we get into the subject of our program today, which is campaign finance, Hillary Clinton, and other related subjects, that I have just established a blog on my website. And it's called, the website is FaderFiles, FederFiles.com, FaderFiles.com. When you go to the home page, you will see my latest article. And when you're done reading the article, this happens to be about President Obama and guns and America, you can comment at the end. So this is a new thing I've set up. Technical stuff is new to me, but I welcome all responses, and I will reply, and you can have a dialogue with other people who have read it. All right, so as we can't all help but know, the presidential... The nominating process for who's going to be the candidate for each party has been going on for, it seems like, many years now. But we are officially in 2016, and we're into the primary stage. So we will find out more, I suppose. Well, who knows what's going on behind the scenes? I get an email maybe every day. I get five emails a day from Hillary asking me, can I contribute just a dollar? Mike, can you contribute just a dollar? However, it is not just a dollar. And this is not a Frank Capra movie we're talking about here. We're talking about something that's not new to a lot of you, but super PACs, political action committees, political action campaigns, and bundlers and rich people funding, in many cases, other rich people who are running for office. And we're going to discuss some of the ethics involved and campaign finance in general. We have with us today Lawrence Noble, who is general counsel of the Campaign Legal Center. Hi, you there?
Hi, I'm here. Great to be with you, Mike.
Yeah, thank you for joining me. Let me give people a touch of your biography so we know who we're listening to. Lawrence Noble is, again, general counsel of the Campaign Legal Center, and prior to joining the Campaign Legal Center, he served as president and CEO of Americans for Campaign Reform, and he was executive director and general counsel of the Center for Responsive Politics, and served as the general counsel of the Federal Election Commission for 13 years, which gives him a lot of inside knowledge about how that place works. And he is also an adjunct professor at the George Washington University Law School, where he teaches campaign finance law and consults on campaign finance, ethics, and lobbying issues. First of all, can you tell us a little bit about the Campaign Legal Center?
Sure. The Campaign Legal Center was started in 2002. And it is a nonpartisan, it's a 501c3 nonprofit organization, and we view our mission as defending democracy and defending voting rights in all its forms. So that's in the campaign finance area, making sure that people have their say, have their input, are not drowned out by the wealthy. In the voting rights area, it's in making sure people have the right to vote and can exercise that right to vote. We also deal with the Federal Communications Commission. We're really about democracy and the concept that democracy belongs to all of us.
The concept, the original ideal in the Constitution and the concept that we learned when we were going to school, however, it doesn't always seem to pan out, especially in, I shouldn't say especially in these days. You know, I'm reading, I just started to read for the first time, Robert Caro's massive biography of Lyndon Johnson. Mm-hmm. And the whole idea of money in politics, I mean, there's absolutely nothing new about it. I don't know. Maybe it started from the day that the country started. But obviously, we have a tremendous increase in this kind of, you know, what is it? What does a presidential campaign now cost at the very end when they finally, when voting day comes, several hundred million dollars, maybe $1 billion?
Oh, yeah. The whole campaign itself will be well over $1 billion. So, we're talking astronomical sums. You know, when you mention how old the issue is, there is actually a record of George Washington having a note of how much money he spent on his campaign, and included rum and included quaint little things like that. But historically, the first real effort at campaign finance reform was from Teddy Roosevelt at the turn of the previous century, because the railroad industry, the insurance companies were seen as basically buying the political parties. And Teddy Roosevelt called for campaign finance reform, and that's the real birth of the modern, or well, at least the real birth of campaign finance reform in this country, and it's been a never-ending game.
A game where, you know, some side wins, some side loses, and it goes back and forth, but lately, it seems to me, unless I'm just being too cynical or I'm just paying attention to the facts, especially with the Supreme Court ruling on Citizens United, things have gone kind of downhill for this side of democracy and, you know, one person, one vote, right?
Yes, I think it has. And, you know, there's a cycle here. As I like to say, there's no end game in a democracy. You're constantly fighting for the rights of the individual and for the say of the individual. But things have gone downhill, and a lot of it has to do with this Supreme Court, which seems to have the view that the wealthy should have more say. This court has said that our elected officials can be expected to pay more attention to their wealthy supporters. And as I like to say, you know, the Supreme Court sees buying of influence as a feature of democracy, not a bug. And I see it's a real problem with democracy that we have a system where people can buy influence. So it's gotten worse because of the Supreme Court, but the problem has always been there. It's one we always have to be vigilant about.
The Federal Election Commission, when was that established, and what exactly is its function?
Well, it was established after Watergate, and Watergate, you know, people think about Watergate as the break into the Democratic Party headquarters, but it was really in large part a money and politics scandal, and what came out of this was slush funds and also the realization that with Nixon's campaign, they were accepting large cash contributions, the conventions were being paid for by wealthy interests. And so we have the Watergate reforms, and from that came the Federal Election Commission. It started in 1974, was immediately held unconstitutional, and then started in 1976, held unconstitutional, and then was reconstituted. It was supposed to be a civil enforcement agency. It was supposed to administer the laws in a nonpartisan manner. It has six commissioners. It does everything by a vote of four, no more than three from any one political party. And the original concept was that it would enforce the laws in a nonpartisan way and do civil enforcement. So it could get penalties, it could make rulings, and it would basically be the organization that kept candidates honest and kept candidates complying with the laws. Mm-hmm. The problem from the beginning was that it's a creature of Congress. So it was created by the people who it regulates. And though early on at least had some sense of mission, there were always 3-3 splits. They tended to be partisan, but there was also a feeling among the commissioners, and I was there for a total of 23 years, that they had to do something. They were there to do a job. What's happened in recent years is that the agency has three commissioners, and they happen to be Republican commissioners, who've been very blunt about the fact that they don't believe in the law. And so it went from splitting when it did split on partisan grounds, where the Democrats would basically defend Democrats, or Republicans would defend Republicans, to splitting on ideological grounds, where now the Democrats vote for enforcement against Republicans and Democrats, and the Republicans vote against enforcement for Republicans and Democrats. And so it's a deadlock. It doesn't do anything. It's a totally dysfunctional agency.
So this agency is created by partisan people to begin with. And so who exactly gets to appoint the commissioners?
Well, that's an excellent question, because originally when the commission was formed, two were appointed by the House, a Republican and a Democrat, two were appointed by the Senate, and two were appointed by the president. And that was declared unconstitutional because of the concept of separation of power. So the way it's done now is the president nominates two commissioners at a time, and the Senate has to confirm them. But the reality is, since the day it was formed, that you can trace which commissioners are considered House appointments, which are considered Senate appointments, and which are considered White House appointments. So they still follow this by tradition, that each House, throughout the House, the Senate, and the President, each get two appointees.
Well, I mean, from the very from the origin of the Federal Election Commission, I mean, it's basically sort of. Yeah, I mean, I know you were there for a long time, but it's a little sort of poisoned at the root, isn't it? I mean, I don't know how you would establish. Is there anything in our government right now? Sometimes I read things about the General Accounting Office reporting things out, or inspector generals from various agencies. Is there any way, I mean, for an election, to have anybody partisan on a commission that polices an election seems to be self-defeating to begin with?
Yes, but there are examples at the state level, with agencies and city level where agencies have worked. So, for example, New York City Campaign Finance Board has generally been considered a good model agency. And it was originally set up, as I like to say, with the proverbial priest as the head of the agency. And there were efforts to rein it in, and it had defenders, and it fought back. Wisconsin, which is an interesting case, had for a long time a very good campaign finance board, and it recently was gutted by the Republicans in Wisconsin because there was an investigation of Rick Walker and a lot of these outside groups. And the way they fought it was they fought it in court. And then the legislature and then the governor did was they basically broke up the agency because it was too effective. So it is hard. What it takes to have a good agency, but it is done in certain places, is it takes a strong structure, and it takes, at the end of the day, like everything else in life, the appointment of people who take it seriously and see their job as answering to the public, not answering to political officials. And then there are ways legislatively you can protect the agency. So it can be done. It has to be done.
How long is it?
It's never going to be perfect.
How long is a term on the to be a federal election commissioner?
It's a 6-year term. Two are appointed at a time, Republican and Democrat, for 6-year terms, but they're staggered. So two are appointed every 2 years.
Can they be removed at the whim of anybody, or are they just in there?
They're basically in there. Not only are they in there, for a very long time, there were no term limits, so they could serve 6 years and be reappointed. And some of them served 19, 20 years. The Republicans got very frustrated because even though the FEC was considered not a strong enforcement agency, it was doing things. It actually did bring cases. It went after Newt Gingrich. It went after presidential candidates. And so the Republicans imposed term limits on the commissioners, meaning they can only serve one term, a 6-year term. And that forced basically the then-current commissioners off the commission. Ironically, what happened after that was once the Republicans got the commissioners that they wanted on the commission, they pretty much stopped reappointing people, or stopped appointing people. So we have, I think now, 5 of the 6 commissioners in what's called holdover status. They've been there more than their 6-year term. There have been no appointments. And one of them has been there, I think, more, is going on finishing her 2nd term, of which only one of those is official. So it's the agency's become a bad joke.
Well, you recently wrote a blog post about Hillary Clinton's campaign finance hypocrisy, and let me get into that with you. You said, now let me just start with the first paragraph. According to Hillary Clinton's campaign website, Hillary's vision for America includes campaign finance reform as an issue. Quote, she will fight for as president, arguing that, quote, we have to end the flood of secret, unaccountable money that is distorting our elections, corrupting our political system, and drowning out the voices of too many everyday Americans, end quote. Those are stirring words, idealistic, and makes you want to just, you know, sing the Star Spangled Banner. But what is more likely the reality here?
Well, the reality is that she is not only using all of the loopholes and various ways around the law that others are, but she's blazing new ground, and that's what this blog post is about, was that she is coordinating, according at least to the super PAC, with one of her super PACs. Now, to back up a moment, we all have heard of super PACs. The concept from the Supreme Court was that they're supposed to be totally independent of the campaign. Therefore, in the court's somewhat myopic view, they won't buy influence because they're independent. But everybody knows that giving $1 million to the super PAC is pretty much the same as giving it to the candidate.
Right.
But at least all the candidates are supposed to go through this charade of being independent from their super PAC.
Well, of course, no average citizen believes that.
No average citizen believes that, but she's taken it a step further, or her super PAC, Correct the Record, has taken it a step further, where they have announced that they're going to coordinate with her. They are coordinating with her, and they have, and I won't go into the details, but they have this legal theory about how they can do that by just doing things on the web. And the point of the blog post is that, you know, one, I think she's wrong. I think they're wrong about this, legally wrong, but you know, it's one thing to say, I'm going to do what everybody else is going to do. I'm not going to unilaterally disarm. So if there's super PACs out there, I'll use one. And then when I get in office, I'll correct that. But it's another thing to blaze the trail and come up with these new ideas of how you can get around the law. And that's what I think is hypocritical, is to come up with something nobody else is doing, which I'm sure others will start doing.
Well, again, this is a part of my cynicism, but since everybody takes it for granted, or everybody I know takes it for granted, that these super PACs are closely coordinated by the candidates, and once again, it's interesting to read Robert Caro's description of the elections in Texas, you know, for Lyndon Johnson for senator, especially in 1948, where there were some flimsy laws in the state of Texas, and I don't know what the national laws were, but basically, you know, giant bags of cash money were transferred back and forth, and sometimes they would be deposited in an employee of some large corporation that was backing Lyndon Johnson. They were deposited in his account, and then, you know, he would withdraw it, and the money was handed out. And for a little bit, though, because Lyndon Johnson was his kind of person, it wasn't good enough for him. So he just went straight down to Texas, where he was campaigning, and went to all these different cities and different towns and handed out the money himself just to make sure the right people got it. And I know there are instances, I suppose this is why Teddy Roosevelt started this stuff in the first place. There are instances I don't know about in plenty of state legislatures where lobbyists were seen giving money on the floor of state legislatures. I think this happened in New York State a couple of times, or more than a couple of times, just handed it to legislators, you know. And I, speaking of Texas, they still say that I've talked to a reporter from Texas once, who said that the place where the lobbyists sit in the state legislature in Texas is called the owner's box. I mean, everybody takes this for granted. So, if David Brock is the person you're talking about who's the head of this PAC, right? Okay.
Right.
And David Brock says that he says, correct the record. Let's see. He's, as far as he's concerned, it's perfectly fine to have coordination. And what is that excuse? I didn't understand that excuse. As long as the influence is only used on the web?
Yeah. So what they're doing is, they say they're doing, is they are... They're coordinating with the campaign, and then they're coming up with ads and doing things that will only appear on the web. They will not appear on television. They will not appear in newspapers, but only on the web. The theory being that the way the FEC rules are written, the web is not covered, which I think is not true. But you know, it's somewhat amusing, I guess, in a depressing sort of way, that they want us to believe, well, the web isn't that important. So we can do it on the web, and it won't really have that much influence.
What is the next? Don't we see a steady progression where all these things are being thrown overboard? I mean, the next step is just literally for the candidate to get direct contributions of money and to coordinate everything and to have a campaign, you know, whoever the campaign director is, to just place, you know, have the whole thing just consolidated, and they just place the ads in TV and radio. I mean, what is this charade, finally? I mean,
And that is the next step, because, I mean, in fact, Ted Cruz has called for that. Some of the candidates have called for that, and they've said that, instead of playing this game, why don't we just lift all the contribution limits on the candidates, or at least lift them on the political parties, so the money can go directly to the political parties and be controlled by the candidates. And that's just, you know, that's like saying, well, crime is too high, so we should just get rid of all of our laws.
Mm-hmm.
The idea here is that wealth does influence people. When you give somebody a lot of money, they tend to want to listen to you. And that is the problem that we're dealing with. We have had times before, most recently with the, let's call the McCain-Feingold Act, or official name was BICRA, Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, in the early 2000s, which did take a system that was awash with soft money, that was unregulated money that the political parties were getting. Bill Clinton was a master at raising that money. And the law cracked down on it, forced the political parties to accept hard money, prohibited candidates from raising money outside the contribution limits, and it worked for a number of years. It actually worked, and the Democratic Party had to start going for smaller donors, and they did. When I say smaller donors, today we're talking about $2,700 per person, which is still out of the reach of 99% of Americans.
Right.
But it worked for a while until the Supreme Court started to undermine it, and then and the FEC undermined the law almost immediately with its regulations. But it did work for a while, and it's crumbled, and the answer is the public has to demand that something be done about it. I think it's an issue that should be raised at every press conference with candidates, with the presidential candidates. Mm-hmm. I think it should be raised at every debate. What are you going to do about this? Are you really telling the American public that $1 million or $10 million contribution to your super PAC doesn't influence you? And do you expect us to believe that?
Where does it say in the Constitution that people aren't allowed to give as much money as they want, or that there should be a limit on political contributions?
It doesn't. It doesn't say that.
But I
also believe the Constitution doesn't say that Congress can't limit it. It comes from where the laws come from in terms of constitutional power is the power to regulate elections. The government, it's been long recognized, the government has the power to regulate elections to keep them free, fair, and honest. That's ultimately what we're about. And so as part of that power, the government has exercised the power to regulate money in elections. The Supreme Court has put a limit on that because the Supreme Court says that it takes money to speak, and therefore you're regulating speech when you regulate money.
Oh, boy.
Now, what that seems to mean is that the wealthy have more speech rights than the rest of us. But it is a constitutional power, and that it comes from the power to regulate elections.
Hmm. Okay. So the campaign legal center, is there any grounds here for a lawsuit that Hillary Clinton's super PAC, Hillary Clinton's, you know, PAC here, is breaking some kind of federal law, or is it just an ethical or a rule problem?
Oh, no, we have filed, we can file complaints with the Federal Election Commission. So we first have to file with the Federal Election Commission, and then they're supposed to investigate the complaints. They don't. And after a while, if they don't do anything, there's a way to sue the Federal Election Commission. It takes a long time. We also have filed complaints with the Department of Justice. Now, we haven't filed them against Hillary yet. We have filed complaints against Jeb Bush, against a number of the other candidates early on about the super PACs. But yes, we can file complaints with the FEC. But we have no faith that the FEC will get four votes to do anything about it.
So the next step is to take it to court, right?
Yes. And there are technical issues there about standing and because the courts have power and the ability to sue. But yes, the next issue is the next possibility is to take it to court. We're talking, years down the road. Well, right now, I should say we're in court, and we've been in court, I think, for 6-8 years now with the Federal Election Commission over the rules they wrote when the McCain-Feingold reform bill came out. Mm-hmm. We've been suing them for years over those rules, that they're not consistent with the law and they let too much activity go on, too much illegal activity go on. So that's what we do.
The income inequality in this country is seemingly completely out of control. The taxes on the rich are almost non-existent. Corporations are moving overseas, so they don't pay their taxes even if they're based here. We have, I think, worse income inequality and all the misery that brings in every area of American life since maybe the Gilded Age, right? Like 100, more than 100 years ago. So this is the way everything is going. And what can an average citizen do? I mean, people can contribute. I'm sure the Campaign Legal Center takes contributions, correct?
Yes, yes. You can go to our website. Yeah, campaignlegalcenter.org and contribute. Yes,
campaignlegalcenter.org. Now, by the way, who really does fund your organization?
Well, we're funded by a number of foundations. We do list all of our funders on our website, we've been funded by the MacArthur Foundation. We've been funded by. I don't want to make a mistake on this.
That's all right.
But if you go to our website, here we go. Okay, so if you go to our website. We have individual donors, but Annenberg Public Policy Center, Carnegie Corporation in the past has funded us. You can see on our website all of our funders.
And you ask for you welcome contributions from small fry too, from regular voters?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, absolutely. We're a legal center, and so, in fact, we just went through a strategic planning thing, where we're trying to reach out more to the public because we are very much kind of the legal law firm, if you will, for a lot of the reform movement in campaign finance area. But we realize we've got to do a better job of reaching out to the public on these issues. Mm-hmm. But yes, we welcome public contributions. Everything helps.
Well, this whole thing is so complex and it's so fascinating, and it's about our laws and our elections, that we are at the end of the half hour allotted for this. Obviously, we could talk much more about it, but I do have another guest coming in. So we have been talking to Lawrence M. Noble. He's the general counsel of the Campaign Legal Center, and it's campaignlegalcenter.org. Now, aside from contributing and getting involved in the work you do, I suppose, by contributions, is there anything else that an average citizen can do in the generally hopeless state they have, that the rich own the country? What can an average citizen do?
Speak up, vote. Voting is incredibly important. I will say to people that if you're not going to vote, then don't complain to me. Find the candidates. They're not all the same. And get involved at the local and state level also. These laws can be changed. They have been in the past, and realize that there is, as I said before, there is no end game in a democracy. This is your democracy. You're going to always have to fight for it. It's not easy to fight for it, but to stop wealth inequality, to stop almost all of the abuses that we're seeing now, people have to get active, and they have to demand that the candidates start responding to them. And I'll tell you that when the candidates believe that money in politics is an important issue to the public, and even though the polling shows it is, they don't believe it yet, then they will start responding to it. Get out there and support candidates.
All right. Thank you very much for coming on. And it's great to know that the Campaign Legal Center is out there doing that, because otherwise you just feel like you're being rolled over by these billionaires. All right, thanks. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Okay. Lawrence Noble from the Campaign Legal Center. So there is a place, and it's a large, effective place that tries to reverse these awful trends. We have another guest coming up. I'm going to focus more on Hillary Clinton and her huge fortune that she has gotten from her and her husband, from speaking to corporations about, you know, doing public speaking and making speeches to corporations over the years, and how this is certainly in many ways unethical, and how it might border on also, you know, making sure that the rich control the government. We'll be with our next guest in just a little bit. First, we'll have a little break. This is Mike Fader, and this is The Turning Point. Stirring tune, right? Very stirring tune. You know, you think of that, and you think of the dignity and the nobility of the introduction of the democratically elected president of the United States, representative of the will of the people. But how much has it ever been that way, and what is it like now? We have a guest today at this part of the hour, who has written a very interesting article about the Clintons paid speech bonanza. That's the title of it. The Clintons, that's both of them, paid speech bonanza. And this was printed in recently online in Consortium News. And our guest is Chelsea Gilmore. Hiya.
Hi, Mike.
Hi. Did you think you were being introduced by Hail to the Chief? Did you?
Somewhat, yes.
All right. Okay, well, that's
a grand entrance.
It's an honor. So Chelsea Gilmore is an assistant editor and fundraising coordinator for ConsortiumNews.com, and she's worked in grassroots fundraising with regional organizations in Richmond, Virginia, and has experience in nonprofit social media outreach and campaigning. And some of her previous articles, one was on an account of a forgotten Civil War training camp for the then newly formed U.S. Colored Troops in Arlington, Virginia. And she also wrote an article on a comprehensive look at Jeb Bush's business ventures before and after his governorship, and various other articles. Tell me about tell us actually about Consortium News.
Yeah, so Consortium News is an independent investigative website. We were one of the first investigative magazines to be based entirely on the internet. We were started back in 1995, and we are almost entirely funded by small reader donations, and otherwise it's just a few family foundation grants. So we really try and strive to keep our independence. We don't want any sort of corporate entities kind of controlling what we having any say in what we write or investigate.
So if somebody goes onto your website, they won't be dancing, you know, automobiles for sale, or
absolutely not. Yep, we've tried to keep ourselves out of the hands of advertisers and corporations alike.
But I know that's a giant struggle these days, right? Because people are always, you know, asking for money because that's, you know, there's just so much to go around, and there's so many websites and so many good websites like Consortium News. I've had Bob Parry on my show. Bob Parry is, I suppose he's in charge of the website, right?
Yeah, yes. Bob Parry is the head editor, and it's pretty much his brainchild. It was started by Bob back in 1995.
So you wrote a recent piece on the Clintons' paid speech bonanza, that's the title, and about Hillary Clinton mostly, and then a little bit about some other candidates and maybe her husband, who could be, I guess his title would be the first man. Is that would be the title if she gets elected?
I think so, yes, right, yeah.
The first man. Anyhow,
yeah.
Let me read the first paragraph of the article. Hillary Clinton is said to be buoyant over her prospects to become the next U.S. president, but perhaps the biggest obstacle still confronting the ex-Secretary of State is her own record as a beneficiary of rich and powerful corporate interests. Let me ask you this, and I had somebody on before, a man named Lawrence Noble, who is the general counsel of the Campaign Legal Center in Washington. Yeah. And over the years, I've been on the air for a long time, talked to a lot of people from various organizations and politicians and all, and we all tend to develop a certain cynical attitude. And you say the biggest obstacle still confronting the ex-Secretary of State is her own record as a beneficiary of rich and powerful corporate interests. Despite whatever she says, I think everybody knows that. And do you think that would ever stop anybody from voting for her? And maybe it does, because she's running against somebody who is very much opposed to that, right?
That's absolutely right, yes. I think you're absolutely right. It is pretty common knowledge that the Clintons have received a lot of funding from these corporate interests. And would it stop people from voting for her? I think we are finally seeing that yes, especially this campaign has been interesting with the emergence of candidates such as Bernie Sanders and even Donald Trump, who's self-financed. You can kind of see this as a backlash against this corporate funding.
Well, Trump doesn't fit exactly into the mold. I mean, the ideal mold, because he's a billionaire all by himself. But somebody like Bernie Sanders is interesting. When you write about, and here you're talking about, let's get into the meat of the article here. Tell us about, Hillary Clinton's, we'll stick to her for a minute. What about her history since she has not been the Secretary of State, since she, you know, resigned as or whatever, left the Secretary of State job, and maybe before that, in, you know, times when she wasn't actually working for the government in one way or another, or as a senator. What was her history? What has been her history? Who has she spoken to? How much money does she raise? And what is this all about?
Right. So what we really focused on with this investigation was specifically the 14-month interim between when she left her position as Secretary of State and before officially announcing her candidacy for presidency in 2016. So that was from January 2014 to March of 2015. And what we saw was that she made 51 paid speeches that brought in a total of $11.8 million, which made up about 38% of her current personal wealth of about $31.3 million. So we started to look at exactly who were these organizations that were paying these fees, how much were they paying her, et cetera. We found that her paid speeches ranged from $100,000 to $335,000, with an average of $230,000.
How long are these speeches that she gives?
On general, between 30 minutes and an hour. So we're not talking very long speeches, pretty brief appearances. Some of her highest compensations that cost the $300,000 mark. Those compensations each were roughly equivalent to six times the typical American middle class earnings an entire year. So it kind of gives you a sense of how much she's making on any given day.
You know, it's not impossible and certainly if you look at American history, it's not impossible that somebody who was wealthy coming into the White House, Roosevelt, actually Lyndon Johnson, mm-hmm. which most people don't know, is one of the richest people who ever became president, although the way he became president. But still, it's not uncommon for Jimmy Carter, had a couple of million dollars. But why would we be upset this time around that somebody so wealthy was coming into the White House? Why should it change our minds about her?
I think it gets to the fact of the staggering amount with which she's being compensated, and the sense that she's also running on this platform. She's made statements of wanting to reform Wall Street and kind of rein it in.
Campaign finance, Wall Street.
Campaign finance. Mm-hmm. Right. But then when you look at, where's this money coming from and what is she actually saying? Who is she saying it to? It starts to...
Well, what organizations has she spoken to? What large organizations? Who has she spoken to?
So during that 14-month period, she spoke primarily to the Wall Street, the tech, and the healthcare industries, especially the tech and the healthcare industries. But also on Wall Street, she spoke, for instance, to Deutsche Bank and to Ameriprise. So, and then... From the tech industry, she spoke to some of the giants such as eBay and Cisco, and then in the pharmaceutical healthcare industry, she spoke to some organizations. For instance, one of her very high-paying paying speeches was to the Biotechnology Industry Organization, and they are an advocacy and lobbying group for companies that do biotech work. So people that make pharmaceutical drugs and biofuels and GMOs, stuff like that.
So she stopped speaking to them when she became an official candidate for president, right? I mean, that would be too much for anybody. Right?
Correct. She did. But that was something that we addressed in the article as well. She was making paid speeches all the way up until March 19th of 2015, which was less than a month before when she officially announced her candidacy on April 12th of 2015. She's not the only candidate to have done that, mm-hmm. to be fair. Jeb Bush also was making speeches up into March. But again, it's these staggering sums that she was compensated with, and the kind of awareness that everybody sort of knew that Clinton's inner circle had been dropping these hints that she would be seeking the candidacy in 2016.
So clearly what this is, for anybody who can, understand simple English and has their eyes open, is that these people, I'm sure that, it might be interesting to go hear her talk for 45 minutes at a convention, and it very well might not be, because it would be a lot of platitudes and who knows what she's talking about. But the whole point is that they're trying to buy the next president. Is that it, or am I being too aggressive about that?
Well, I wouldn't want to necessarily make that statement.
I made it. You didn't. I know.
Absolutely. But it does raise the suspicion, right? It looks a little fishy. Why would these companies be paying such exorbitant amounts just to hear a 45-minute speech?
Now, obviously, this is not against the law, since everybody does it. And her husband is probably more famous for this and has made more money at it than anybody in presidential history or political
history,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And you talk about that in your article, too, right?
Correct, yep. In that same period, that same 14-month period, he made about $13.3 million from delivering 53 paid speeches. So,
So this money, maybe I should have asked the guy from the Campaign Legal Center, do you know whether or not all this money that the Clintons have raised, their own personal money, can they use this for their political campaigns?
I think, actually, Larry Noble would probably be a better person to confirm that. Sorry, unfortunately, I don't know.
Yeah, that's something maybe I should find out from him, and then I could tell people about it. So these speeches, so the two of them together, you make something here where it was hard for me to actually credit. Let me see. There's something. How much money the two of them raised over time since the two of them left the White House? How much money have they raised from various sources for their organizations or for themselves or their charities? How much money? I think you mentioned it somewhere. Yeah.
I think I do have that number. I can't remember it off the top of my head. Since the beginning of, well, I don't know if this is helpful, but since the very beginning of when they first started fundraising.
Mm-hmm. This goes all the way. I see it here in your article. The Washington Post did an investigation, and it says the Post investigation found that since Bill Clinton's 1974 congressional bid, so it goes back mm-hmm. to the beginning of his political career. The grand total raised for all, that includes Bill and Hillary's political campaigns and their family's charitable foundation, reaches at least $3 billion.
Yep, with at least $69 million of that from political contributions from
Wall
employees
Street.
And PACs of banks. Yeah, Wall Street, essentially.
Banks, insurance companies, securities and investment funds, wealthy hedge fund managers, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. There was something else that she said. So she's claiming that she's going to, of course, you know, everybody says these things, and she's claiming that she's going to really clamp down on Wall Street. I mean, the laws are in place. Nobody's enforcing the laws. Nobody's been to jail for the 2008 swindle of the American people and destruction of the economy. But she's going to reform campaign finance. We already had Larry Noble on here talking about how hypocritical that is because her super PAC is breaking every rule there is, more than almost anybody else. And she's going to clamp down on Wall Street. And I'll ask you the same question I ask him. I mean, you've done all this research and you read all this. You're a voter. What is your personal feeling about what choice do we have finally? I mean, let's say she becomes, is it always the lesser of two evils? I mean, I'm asking a lot of stuff here, but, you know, if Bernie Sanders, who, let's say, people like you and I might be more predisposed to vote for, you know, for various reasons that we're talking about, let's say she becomes the candidate and she's running against, I don't know, Jeb Bush or Rubio or all these people who are all backed by the same people, basically. They all bet on the same candidate. They all bet on different candidates just in case they win, right? How do you feel as a voter? I mean, and what do you think that individual voters can do about this kind of stuff?
Well, I think that individual voters, again, I think Mr. Noble said it as well. Obviously, vote, but don't just vote for anybody. You really, and what this article tried to do as well is always follow the money,
mm-hmm.
because that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an old saying, but it really, really, to be crass, pays off. You have to follow the money because that's really where you're finding out where people put their money where their mouth is. So as a voter, it's easy. Yes, I know it is easy to get disheartened, but that's why it's important to know, to start early, to start your research early, and to find out who's
paying
lining up with. Yeah. Right, well, yeah, who's paying for what, and also, yeah, who's. Which candidates' actions are lining up with their words, and where's that money coming from?
There's something in your article which is interesting here. Let me refer to this. If you just tuned in, we're listening to Chelsea Gilmour, that's Gilmour, and she is the assistant editor and fundraising coordinator for ConsortiumNews.com, and then the title of the article is "The Clintons' Paid Speech Bonanza." And you should check it out online, the Clintons' paid speech bonanza. During the November 14th Democratic presidential debate, when Hillary Clinton was pressed about her acceptance of Wall Street largesse, and she sought to justify her financial support from Wall Street as somehow related to her work as New York senator following the 9/11 attacks on the Twin mm-hmm. Towers of the World Trade Center. And she said, according to your article here, you quoted her, "I represented New York on 9/11 when we were attacked," Clinton said. "Where were we attacked? We were attacked in downtown Manhattan where Wall Street is. I did spend a whole lot of time and effort helping them rebuild. That was good for New York. It was good for the economy, and it was a way to rebuke the terrorists who had attacked our country. And this stirred up a lot of reaction, didn't it?
Mm-hmm. There was a lot of backlash from people that saw that and thought it was absolutely incorrect to try and make a comparison to accepting Wall Street donations and 9/11.
So, following the money, absolutely. So, when she speaks to some of these places, like she spoke to eBay, paid her. I don't know. That's a convention or something she went to. But then she also has what makes it even more unethical and makes it smell even worse is that she gets political. She gets campaign donations from the president of eBay. Then, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. The president of eBay is. Is a big supporter, and it was less than a couple months later, she went to the chief executive, John Donahoe, and his wife's house for a big fundraiser. So not only had she received compensation for making this short speech to eBay employees, she was then hosted at a fundraising party at the chief executive of eBay's house.
Hmm. So this article is available on consortiumnews.com. And when you go to consortiumnews.com, contribute some money to them. And I've been talking to people from this organization, especially Bob Parry, who is a journalist, goes back to the 80s, who investigated the Iran-Contra affair and other things. They really are a very deserving organization. Once again, it's the Clinton's paid speech bonanza, and the author of the piece is Chelsea Gilmore. So if you really want to find out the details of who she raised money from, who she spoke to, and the way she is, and who she really represents, this is a good place to check it. Thanks for coming on today, Chelsea.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. This is Mike Fader, and we have just a couple of minutes left. Yeah, we have a couple of minutes left before the end of the hour here. I struggle these days, and I know we all struggle, but I struggle these days with politics in general, with the whole political system. And I do hear from, I think maybe all of you are on, depends if you're, if you ever gave money to the Democrats before or if you gave money to President Obama when he was running, to Barack Obama when he was running, or to any other Democratic affiliated organization. You get on lists, they all trade their lists. And speaking of money, they buy their lists or trade them off. And I get emails several times a day from Bernie Sanders people and from Hillary Clinton's people. I got one the other day, and this is all, faceless personal relationship on the internet, which is completely artificial, is a message from Hillary, a personal message to me from Hillary. And it's asking for $1. Will I donate $1? Makes me feel like a fool, right? Makes me feel like a fool because I know that my $1, if I actually send her $1, and it's signed Hillary, of course, if I send her, because she's so personal, if I send her $1, what difference is that going to make? Does that mean that I get to have lunch with her and help to and tell her what my opinions are about things, that I ultimately will advise her on legislation? I don't think so. I think we all know that these corporations are they own and they run the country. So, but I don't want to be so utterly cynical. After all, you have to vote. You're a member of. At least a theoretic democracy, and you want to preserve it, so you have to do the best you can. I guess Bernie Sanders is the only person I could imagine even voting for. And I can only hope that we'll see how he does in these primaries. I think that's about all the time we have for today. But money and politics between the Supreme Court and between income inequality and the erosion of the middle class, it is becoming more and more of a plutocracy. An oligarchy, whatever word you want to use, and less of a democracy. The only way to get it back is for us, you and me, to do something about it. Okay, thanks a lot.
The best things in life for free. But you can give them to the birds and bees. I want money. Such a thrill. But your love won't pay my bills. I want money. Everything, it's true. What it don't get, I can't use. I want money.